Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. It's like coffee with an analyst, or it could be whiskey with an analyst reading a spreadsheet, linking crime events, identifying a series, and getting the latest scoop on association news and training. So please don't beat that analyst and join us as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Elder, and today our guest has 4 years of law enforcement analysis experience. He's currently an analyst with the Harris County Sheriff's Office in Texas, and he's in the Air Force Reserves as an intelligence analyst in the geospatial intelligence area. He's here to talk about, among other things, social network analysis and analyzing jail calls. Please welcome Anthony Bush. Anthony, how are we doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me. Good afternoon. How are you today?
I am very, very well. It was a pleasure meeting you. We met at the IACA conference there in Dallas this past year, and so I am glad that we're able to reconnect today.
Yeah, I'm glad to be a part of the podcast. I listened to several episodes, and I really think it's good to get out there. I think the crime analyst job or position is still in the shadows after decades and decades of being existent.
Yeah, it's definitely in its infancy. I don't know where, maybe we're kids. I don't know where we're at, but we're definitely not in adulthood, I feel. We're definitely not middle age, that's for sure. We still got a lot of growing to do in terms of this profession. So,
agreed.
All right. So, how did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
So, I started my intelligence journey in the military as a geospatial intelligence analyst. And so, pretty much that job is just looking at satellite imagery or FMV imagery, and then just sort of making intelligence-based products based on that. And we can go into that later. But I met somebody, and if I wanted to kind of pursue it further, I had to go down to Houston. And so when I was trying to make that transition, I was searching for any sort of job that had intelligence in it. And then I discovered an intelligence analyst, and I had some time. So I was going to school for criminal justice, and I was applying for all sorts of jobs. And so that's how I kind of stumbled upon it, just internet research. And that's why I said it's sort of almost like a hidden job, because when I first came upon it, I was like, oh, wow, like it makes perfect sense. Like, we have intelligence on all other sorts of things. Like, why don't we have it for crime, like local crime?
Yeah. So then you're originally from Iowa?
So I kind of moved around a lot. I grew up in Washington State, and then around age 14, we moved to the we moved to the Iowa-Minnesota border. And then when I was there, I went to school for computer science. I tried to get a job there and didn't pan out. And then I joined the military as sort of like a ticket there. And so, but yeah, eventually I was active duty, and I switched over to the guard, and I joined a unit there in Des Moines, Iowa, the capital there. And I liked it. There's really a lot of morale, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah. So that was quite a transition though. So you got your degree and then you went into the military. And so that's sometimes people do it the other direction. They'll go in the military first, and then after they get out of the military, they'll use the GI Bill or whatever it is to go to school.
No, I agree. Like, I mean, that does happen a lot. When I was there in the Guard, we had a lot of people who they would go to university, and they would do the weekends, like one weekend a month, and then they do the 2 weeks during the summertime. And when they had downtime in the summer in the military, when you're in the guard, you can tell them, like, I want a job, and they'll get you on what's called orders, and then you could work there 8 hours a day. And so, I mean, it really works well, like, with students. I'm not trying to sell it too much, but it is a pretty good setup. They'll pay for your school, and then when you have off time, you can tell them, like, hey, can I come in full time and work? And they'll be like, yeah, here you go. And it's good job experience. For me, I tried. Rural Iowa isn't the fields of opportunity for computer science degrees. I had an interview with the school, and I was around 21 at the time, so I couldn't interview that well, I think, and I kind of blew it. And then I was like, oh, what other opportunities do I have in rural Iowa? And so I was like, I'll just join the military. It worked out.
It's not a build it and they will come type of thing?
No. There's jobs there if anybody wants to go. The low income, and there's manual labor jobs and factory jobs. There you go.
Yeah. So when you go to the military, are you seeking out intelligence, or is that something that you developed later in your military career?
I sort of sought it out. Initially, when I joined, I talked with the recruiter and I said I wanted to go intelligence. I watched a lot of like these video games and watched a lot of stuff on the Sci-Fi Network. And I was like, oh, if I get into intelligence, I'll know all about the aliens and laser beams and secret societies. And let me tell you what, like I got the clearance and you don't. It's not that at all. But so I try to go intelligence and the recruiter said, oh, no, just go open general. So I did 3 years in the medical lab, which was an interesting job. But as I got progressed further and further in the military, I realized that the recruiter was telling fibs and I totally could get an intelligence job. And so I contacted the Air Force Guard base there in Des Moines. I asked for if they had any job openings and they said, yeah. Yeah, we have this one for imagery analysis. And so I really didn't know what it was. And so I was like, just sign me up. It has intelligence in the name. It sounds cool. And maybe I'll learn all about the aliens and things like that. But
yeah. But so is that something that's a fascinating look, too, because that's not really something that a law enforcement analyst usually is going to have access to. Right. You can get in terms of imagery the snapshot of GIS, but it's not something where it's like, oh, this picture was taken yesterday. Here, let's analyze it type of thing, which is maybe what you got into there with the military.
Yeah, yeah. There's, of course, like you have better quality and more frequent images of different things. Like one interesting thing, too, is people think, oh, you look at images, it must all be like military type stuff. But it could be all sorts of things. You know, it can be like infrastructure or other buildings. Doesn't always need to be like the Soviet sub fleet in Bulgaria or wherever. Like, but it is those. It's sort of ironic in the sense that when I got into law enforcement, just like almost that transition, the amount of information I actually felt that I had access to was a little bit more in law enforcement. Like I talked to, because like I'm still in. And so I talked to fellow analysts there during drill weekend and I sort of tell them a bit about the job and what we can do, how like automated license plate readers work or transcription services for calls and all their sorts of elements. And it's actually almost a lot more than from what my particular job was. Like one thing that's, I think, not widely advertised, I guess, like in military, it's a lot of things are like I can't say the word, but you know, compartmentalized, like you only necessarily do one thing and only have access to that one stuff. So like the freedom's not there. You very much have to color within these lines, but with law enforcement, like depending on the environment, the world's your oyster and you can do all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah. And I mean, I've talked to a lot of analysts that they're only analysts at a police department, and they're definitely the jack of all trades. So they're getting into all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. Whereas once you get to these larger agencies, we need someone to do X, and that's what you're going to be doing X, analyzing maybe burglaries and robberies in this particular area. And that's your little playground there. So I find it fascinating, though, with the military. And do you have any particular like stories or anything that can kind of drive home what you were getting into in terms of the geospatial analysis?
Yeah, the one thing I want to say, there's a lot of unique opportunities. And so, for example, there's these different operations that take place and you can volunteer to go on them. And like I was in South Korea for about 3 weeks when they did like sort of an air war simulation. And so we helped support that simulation. And like actually two of my teammates, they both got COVID. I said, this is during COVID. And one of the big achievements was I sort of did this job of like two or three people sort of all by myself. And I just like deputized some people to assist with it, but we got it done when it really wasn't that big of a difference. I mean, like they noticed a slowdown in the simulation type stuff, but like the one real big thing is, and this was when I was in Iowa, we were doing some work. I was helping some guy do some work for the United States Strategic Command. And it was just had to get certain images. They wanted to update some stuff. And so like, hey, can you get an image like this and an image like that? And when I was working on some of them, I noticed something that wasn't necessarily highlighted before. And so I pointed it out to my supervisor and then he pointed out to his supervisor. And then it sort of went all the way up the chain of command and got referenced to them. And with this particular facility, it would be like a critical element. And what? Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like a little sidetrack, but the way that the United States kind of works, I think is pretty cool, is it was always explained to me, and this is all unclassified type stuff, is one bomber today is about 200 bombers during World War II because of targeting. And the aspect is like, you just have to look at like the focal point of an area or an operation. And if you just destroy that one small thing, you disable everything there. Like you could destroy, like if it's a chemical plant of some kind and there's like a pump house that's pumping liquids throughout the chemical plant, like you could blow up that pump house and then therefore that place can't pump liquids anymore. So like in the old days, you'd have to like blow up that whole area, but now you just have to blow up that one small thing. And so I found like a critical element in this image that had been missed a while back ago. And so it was sort of a little highlight for the unit. They had some political representatives who came by just to do like sort of like a dog and pony show to be like, this is what we do. Here's some of our highlights. And it was highlighted to some state representatives in Iowa of it. And it was a nice little accomplishment. And
yeah. So you took out their outhouse or what did you do?
Pretty much. No, it is. I would be upset if we had to go dig a hole somewhere. And
oh, man. So you mentioned the focal point with the military versus the analyst job that you have. And one of the things I've noticed in talking with people with military analysis background is it seems like in the military there is so much more documentation, and that there are people, analysts, that okay, you're going to study this topic and you're going to write about it. Or you're going to study this topic and you're going to present on it whenever we need it presented on. So be ready type of thing. And so there does seem like in that regard, there's just so many reports to read. Whereas on the civilian side, in terms of law enforcement analysis, there might be a strategic plan or a strategic report, but we don't do a lot of writing in that way. I don't think many people do. And so I don't know if that's something that you can echo in your experience, or from your experience, it's contrary.
Yeah, most definitely. With the military, there is a lot more documentation, for everything almost. When you're getting trained for your job, for example, there's every single task needs to get signed off with a trainer and something, and sort of like an initial that, you know, Airman Bush was able to open up Microsoft Excel. Like, that's a checkbox. They were able to do this, this, and this. And then there's documentation for how everything sort of like, just like almost a style guide. And with the style, like everything needs to be exactly this way. And it's good. It keeps things standard. But part of the issue is you run into situations where the guide and just sort of your guidelines don't really line up. Like it could say use 12-point font, but when you're trying to put it here on some image and it's so busy, 12-point font won't work. You have to go to 10, or it might be so small, like you have to increase it. And there is more documentation almost in the sense of like, let's say you want to make a call. You said like, oh, I don't think that ship is there, or I don't think this is like this. And you do need to like sit there and like go on the old military internet webs and do lots of Googling and figuring it out. Like, is it there? Is that supposed to be there? Where is it? Like, is that what I think it is? And definitely have to double check multiple times. It's much more, you have to be 100. Well, a lot of times you have to be more sure. And like in law enforcement, at least as a crime analyst, like you could say, hey, I think this is your suspect. You should go. This is just an investigative lead. This is not the gospel. And it's a little bit more forgiving.
Hmm. All right. And I'm to the audience. I will get to Harris County Sheriff's Office. I will. But I'm curious just to finish this up. Is the maybe some other differences in terms of your time as a military intelligence analyst versus a civilian?
I honestly think civilian crime analysts or civilian analysts are much more busy. It might just be the 2 to 3 different areas I've been to, but I definitely think, you know, as a civilian, you're a lot more busy. You have a lot more requests and a lot more things placed upon you. Somebody could send you a request and you start working on it and you kind of discover something big and it's developed legs And it's like, oh, you mentioned a gray truck, and I research a gray truck, and I start linking other, you know, armed robberies using like a gray truck. But as you're mid doing that, then another request comes in from the chief, and they want calls for service at this hospital for this thing that they're doing today at noon. And it's like having to juggle a lot more requests. It isn't necessarily like that, I think, in the military. Well, from the military that I've been a part of in my little groups, it's been much more, here's your target. It's kind of complicated and it's long-winded. And that's why we kind of gave it to the reserves, so because you guys have the time to deal with it. But it is very much more, I think, sort of fast-paced, at least with our agency, kind of due to our size. We have almost 5 million people. It's around 1,800 square miles in Harris County.
Wow. Okay. So now let's get there then. So you've got the military, you've got the background, and you're going in as an analyst for the first time in the sheriff's office. So like, just take us back to that point, some of the things that you were experiencing, maybe some things that are issues at this time.
So my entry into crime analysis was sort of shocking, I want to say, just based upon my supervisor. He's a civilian, he's a manager. I think he had too much faith in me. I've never really done crime analysis before. I came in there and I asked to train with some other people, some other crime analysts in our agency. Recently, our agency reformed. By recently, I mean a couple of years ago. But prior to that, all of our crime analysts were very sort of separated into our own little groups. And I was doing stalking and domestic violence. I was working with those investigators, and I asked my manager, I said, oh, can I like shadow some other analysts, kind of learn the ropes of the job? And I say I got about 2 days, and then I was like, oh, I really think I need more than 2 days. And he's like, oh, you're smart. You'll pick it up. You know what you're doing. And I was like, oh, no, no, I don't. Eventually, I did pick it up. Mm-hmm. But I think I just kind of picked it up because I was able to just, it's very interesting, like crime analysis, it's sort of all over the place. And so you can be good at one or two skills, and it could carry you through some of your shortfalls. And then as you keep going, you get better at those. So that skills you're not necessarily as good at, and that's carry you through.
You mentioned the size and the population. How many analysts are at the sheriff's office?
So overall, our analyst group, I want to say, has roughly 22 people in it. But that's including the lieutenants, the sergeants, our admins. But peer analysts we have, I'd say probably about 17.
Okay.
We weren't a part of a study, but we talked to one of the doctors, I believe it was Dr. Herbert, Jessica Herbert, and she was saying the formula, we should have 55 analysts for the population that we deal with. And so we get a lot done with as much.
Yeah. Well, that's three times as much as you have. Like, that is a lot.
It keeps things exciting, though. It keeps things exciting.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so, but no, that is really, even that many to have 17 is impressive, and the coordination involved that has to go on to make sure that everything gets done and nothing falls through the cracks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it does. It does. Being all of our analysts are housed at one location, and I really do think that helps a lot, because you could get a request and you might not be able to know how to fulfill it, but there's people there who do know how to fulfill it. And like, say, for example, like you're not the best at mapping. You have four or five people who are good at mapping, and then you can just open the door and walk over to their room and be like, hey, how do I map this data? And they'll definitely help you out.
Yeah, that was the big difference that I found once I worked in a unit as opposed to just being an analyst assigned at a police department. I was like, oh, we talk the same language. I can use you as a soundboard and you can give me recommendations on stuff that you actually did. And so it's a big difference. It's a good feeling to actually be part of the team as opposed to being a sole analyst on their own.
No, 100%. It's good because like somebody could be working on something and you can offer to help out, or you can help build on it. One of my coworkers, her name's Iris Reyes. She was working on this small gang of gentlemen who were stealing rims and tires. They were riding along the apartment complexes, opening up their minivan and running out and stealing rims and then loading back up and taking off. And she made the product. And then a couple months later, I had a completely separate request, and I was able to use her information to really build on top of it, to really like expand it and link it. And if we were in separate locations, I would not have known that she would have made that product. But she was sitting right behind me, and she's like, I know that guy. And I was like, really? And it was pretty helpful. And then just even knowing what tools exist, and then access for those tools. There's a lot of programs that are expensive, and there's only a handful of licenses that like our agency has. And being co-located with somebody, you can go to them and be like, hey, can I use your clear access to look up this person or something like that.
I really enjoy working from home, but I do understand there in the cubicle environment, there is chatter that I was made aware of that I wouldn't normally be made aware of if I either had an office or I was working from home. So there's something to be said about the cubicle bullpen environment.
Oh, it's entertaining. It's like, not going to gossip on here, but then you hear the little gossip of, oh, did you hear what happened in the other room or what so-and-so did with the taco tin? And it's colorful. Like, I think everybody at our job really gets along well, but it's still kind of funny. Like, oh, I went into the bathroom. It smells real bad. I think so-and-so blew it up in there. And it's just like, chuckle.
So then when you get there and you're learning the ropes and trying to do your thing, I mean, what problems are trying to be solved there at Harris County? What are some major issues?
So, like I said, our first major issue was called Partnerships for Public Safety. It was Dr. Herbert came in and kind of analyzed our whole little group, because our sheriff wanted to do more data-driven approaches to reducing crime, because we weren't, before me, I'm not sure how much of it was being done. There's two or three analysts, but like I said, we had like 15 or 16 and not everybody. And I'll admit I wasn't one of them. Using Excel, using SQL, making reports with maps and charts and things like that, it wasn't exactly commonplace. Mm-hmm. And so she talked to the sheriff, made recommendations, and we all combined together. And that's how it kind of really took off. But some of the real big problems that they're really tackling that I noticed was that in my 4 years I've been there has been violent crime. And I like to think the sheriff's office does a really good job with trying to tackle violent crime with robberies. There's a lot of effort put into there. There's a lot of integration with other agencies at the Texas Anti-Gang Center. It's interesting. It's almost like a fusion center, but their whole focus is gangs, and a lot of different agencies work there. I go there sometimes and we exchange data to go, and they target mainly violent gangs, or sorry, violent crime related to gangs. But it is somewhat interesting though, because we're starting to almost look at more jail information with like the sheriff's office itself, because the standard sheriff's office, they're mainly concerned with the jail and with courts. But I mean, ours is unique because we have that element, and we also are the law enforcement agency for over 1 million people on the outskirts of Harris County. So if you're to look at a map of jurisdiction, you have HPD, Houston Police Department, in the middle, and then all other incorporated Harris County is the sheriff's office.
Yeah, and that's always interesting, because it's fascinating to me that you have that concept of the city, which is usually a concentrated area, and maybe more dense in terms of population, maybe during certain times, like during the business day is way more people in there than maybe at night. But then when you get to the sheriff's office, and you hit it earlier that you're talking about 20 some square miles and 5 million people, and that's a different ball game trying to analyze and work with that such large area as opposed to a concentrated area of the city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it definitely is. We're working on it. We had a new mayor, and he's really pushing a new crime reduction strategy with HPD kind of at the forefront. But we're obviously pushing a lot towards it. But it's tough in the aspect of, let's say, if you're trying to map burglars and motor vehicles in the city, and we map all ours, and right there in the middle of the map, there's a huge black hole with no mm-hmm. data, because like the RMS systems aren't joined, so like we can't necessarily map their data, and so it's a bit tricky. And that's one thing I didn't expect going in. I thought everybody saved everything on one big happy like data server, and you could just search crime and span multiple cities and states and things like that.
But, oh, no. I mean, that's why when I talk to folks from different countries, and they're like, oh, yeah, we have one police department. So yeah, I can get that data. It's just more like probably what you would have experienced in the military. It just takes the right paperwork in order to get that data, right? It's there, and it will be in the same format, and you'll be able to get it. Whereas in the United States, this 17,000 agencies that we have, it will still take paperwork to get permission. But then even once you do get it, it might not be in the same format that you're expecting.
Agreed. Or they're missing something. It's like, oh, I really wanted latitude and longitude on it, and they just gave you maybe the address, and it's tough, and then you have to request it again and wait a couple days. And no, it's very interesting.
I just had Kurt Smith on, and I think I've said this already a couple of times, but he said that he's surprised that there's not a required standard that all RMSs can be able to share data. Like, you have a back end in which, okay, you have to be able to across the board share data. And no matter what your GUI and your front end looks like, you have to have these standard fields in the background, and they have to be in a certain format, and you have to give the ability for all agencies to share data.
In my 4 years, it's sort of slowly going there, but via just third party. For example, there's this one third party software called Coplinks X that our tag, I think, is paying for it to get a lot of people's subscriptions. And that sort of does what it does, is like ingest all these RMS data and try to do it that way. But no, I definitely agree. As a citizen, not being in the thick of it, you would think that would be kind of like a standardized thing. Like, everybody has to have their social, like a driver's license system where you can search it, and it's the same throughout and should be able to pull up photos and everything, but not with crime incidents. No,
that would be too easy. That would be too easy.
Hey, this is Freddie Croft, Lieutenant with HPD. My public service announcement is to encourage people to get a T model of skill acquisition. Learn a broad set of skills across many different things, and then find one that interests you and dive deep into that. Learn and become a subject matter expert in it. Doing that will allow you to be extremely successful in your career.
Hi, this is Dawn Reby, 22 plus years in law enforcement analytics and CEO of Excellence in Analytics. And here's our public service announcement of the day. Hire a qualified coach. The process of growth and development is not easy. And quite honestly, many professionals in service-based industries have their wheels spinning for years. It just doesn't work. It doesn't get better. You can only see through your lenses. Hiring a coach is the best thing that I did years ago, and I still have one today. I love the clients we coach. They get results, and those results are real. They build confidence, they create better work-life harmony, they excel in their careers, and they simply have more joy. It is possible. Get yourself there faster by hiring a qualified coach.
So let's get an idea of some of the work that you've done here. Let's go to your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the career-defining case or project that you worked. And so yours, I believe, is a fascinating one, but unfortunately incomplete. So I know that you're only going to be able to tell me so much of the story, but let's just give me what you can, and I'm fascinated to hear that in more detail.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll wrap up. The case itself has actually gone federal, and everybody always makes those jokes that the FBI steals your case. They stole my case. Trust me. I was working with an analyst for HPD, and the FBI was working on it as well. And she's real close, and we all still kind of work together and talk. But she's like, I didn't want to tell you. Don't get your hopes up. But I thought maybe it'd be different. But nope, they still could. But anyways, it's ongoing, and they're kind of taking the head of the spear with that one. But so pretty much the case was, this was in, I'd say probably roughly 2021, around that time frame, several years ago. And we worked with Dan Howard and Deborah Peel and Don Reby, and they came to the Harris County Sheriff's Office, and they're really pushing this DDAX model. And for those who don't know, it's data-driven approaches to crashes and traffic, or crime and traffic. And then the concept is like, hey, placing law enforcement where the most crashes are and the most crime, and people, it'll be deterrence for both. And the pullovers that they do, like they pull people over, it'll increase arrests and things like that. So there was different hotspots, and I was assigned to this one hotspot, which was the most active spot for violent crime and kind of all crime overall in Harris County, in unincorporated Harris County. And that was pretty much on the north side of Harris County. And so I asked one of our gang sergeants, I said, hey, Sergeant Schmidt, what is some of the gangs that are working there? And so the very first gang he told me was like a smaller gang of 60 people. And I was recently given access to gang data as far as gang data and jail data combined, because the sort of the linchpin that I needed was people's like inmate numbers, so I could search jail calls based upon gang status and inmate phone numbers. So I talked to him, and just sitting there thinking, I didn't even realize it was called social network analysis. I said, I'm going to download all these 60 people's jail phone calls and see who they're all calling, and then listen to some of those calls, search the calls, and see what's there. And I did it for the gang, and there's one individual who's called by five different members. And it turns out when you sort of research that phone number, it was one of the gang members himself. And then I talked to Mr. Schmidt, and he said, yeah, he's one of the three founding members. And so I was like, okay, that's cool. And so I said, like, let's scale it up some. And so I asked him, and he gave me the name of what's called like the Red Gang. So the Red Gang has 300 people in the area operating. And so I just repeated the same process with them. And I downloaded, I'd probably say 3 years of phone calls. And then I looked at the calls. I mean, I put them in Excel. And so if people don't have social network analysis software, you can kind of do it in Excel without even trying. Well, I mean, without having to get the expensive software. And it's pretty much, you just delete all the excess phone calls based upon dialed phone number and inmate, because you have people who call their girlfriends multiple times or their wives or the husbands. And so that sort of falsely inflates the numbers. But so you just delete the duplicates. So you have one phone call per inmate per dialed phone number. And then you just do a pivot table, and then you see what phone number has the most unique number of like contacted individuals. And so what that little pivot table is kind of representing is, let's say this one phone number here has been contacted by 12 different documented gang members of like the Red Gang. And so what you did then, you can search multiple calls all at once. And so I listened to the top 10 phone calls, trying to find different keywords that people might mention. And so I hit on a conversation. People talk a lot of crime on their jail calls and don't realize it says it's recorded, but they ignore that part. And so it led to an investigative lead. And then I started working up a little bit more, worked with our investigators. They started subpoenaing some other records, and it turned into like the claims on the phone calls were correct. And then the subpoenas for their documents were correct. And then they kept on going more and more, and they started subpoenaing more things. And it just sort of, I want to say, exploded in scope. So pretty much it's a multi-agency case that's federal, and it all just happened just because people were talking reckless on the phone, and it really did sort of lead and snowball up to something big. And so hopefully it'll lead to federal charges for more than half a dozen people. So, but we'll see, it's still ongoing. But that was sort of like almost the big bad story, was how no one's really using jail calls to link up things together. It doesn't just need to be gangs. It could be people of the same crime type or people in a certain region.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that this is a large case now, but it's all because you started pulling on the thread, so to speak. You could have just done simple searches and done just the bare minimum and moved on to either the next case or the next task, but you started digging in and started using this other data set or this other type of analysis to bring more to the table. And I think it is a perfect analyst badge story in that case, because all of this is because you did something extra, and now it's this large case. I understand that you lost it to the FBI, but that's almost a compliment in this case, that something you did is now a federal investigation.
It is. I mean, my coworkers probably get tired of me talking about it. Like, geez, get something new to talk about. But I'm like, no, I'm still upset and salty and bitter about it. But
yeah. It's like you got one good joke and you tell that joke well.
No, agreed. That's the other thing. Like, and is I think if you find something that might be more than just the average, it's like if you try to work it up a little bit more and you try to like sell it to somebody and they're just like, oh, thanks, but you can keep kind of working it up to add some more color to it. And then eventually people will buy and they'll take it and they'll work on it. And that's the one thing I really, really learned about just intelligence overall is you could figure out exactly who's selling drugs where and all that aspect. But if you don't necessarily package it up and sell it well enough with pictures and charts and a map, it doesn't go as far. It doesn't have as much legs.
Yeah, I think it's how many days did you work on this, or what was the time frame initially when you start working on this to where you get to the point where you are listening to calls and you're subpoenaing subscriber information, I would assume, and like how much time goes into this initially?
I mean, the initial part that I was a part of the investigation, me just researching on my own before bringing it up to anybody, it was probably, I'd say, about 2 months. Mm-hmm. And then the investigation obviously has been ongoing, but like I was sort of assisting them, I'd say, for probably 6 or 7 months afterwards. And then I still play a small part here and there. Like they come back and say, like, hey, can you like look at this or look at that? Like that's one very interesting thing people don't know about the FBI is they don't have access to the same amount of information that crime analysts do, like locally, just because they have a lot of certain rules that prevent them from using it. Like they can't, for example, like pawn records, like they have access to pawn records and things like that. But at one point in time, like they didn't have access to pawn records, for example. So there's still stuff that they have to come to us local agencies or state agencies for help with. But it was out of the whole thing I generated. So the sheriff's office, at least ours, they don't necessarily pay overtime as much, but you can get like comp hours. Like if you work afterwards, you'll get like vacation hours that you can use at some other point in time. And I got around like 120 extra hours. And
oh, wow.
It was pretty nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then do you still have those or did you use them?
I've been using them. I'm down to around 40 or 50. And I was like,
good for you.
I need to get on something else again to build this back up.
Yeah. Good for you. Because every once in a while, it's just like, yeah, I got all this time. And I was like, okay, don't let that time expire. Actually use that time. That's good for you that you're actually using that time. And I think with law enforcement analysts at times, they only have access to data. And so there's only so much that they can glean from that data. We talked about the lack of documentation before, is that if you're just looking at data, you don't have a lot of documentation. You're really relying on detectives to go back and forth, feed you information. You get going back and forth as your analysts are doing the research, and because you're limited. In this case, because you were able to listen to the calls, in essence, that's a report, that's a documentation in a way that you were able to listen to the recording. And that's definitely a whole other level of data that you can analyze and helps you corroborate what the data is telling you.
Like I very much agree. There's just backing it up almost for like just reading. If you just have access to the data, like RMS incidents, it's really frustrating when like you're reading a BMV report and they just give you two or three sentences and you found a suspect and you're trying to link them to more BMVs and they just don't give you that much data. It's really difficult to. But in this instance here, I think I was able to go so far in it just because the powers that be at the time really believed in our crime analysis unit. And they said, you know what, let's give you access to more data, not less data. And they gave people who kind of knew how to use SQL access to more different databases in SQL, which more of the criminal justice element aspect, some of the jail data. And we were able to take that and kind of fuse it and run. And kind of like how I mentioned, like trying to like sell it to people, I really try to use jail calls in a lot of different things, because you could mention like John Smith is the leader of the Blue Gang, but if you like necessarily listen to calls that John Smith made from jail or calls to John Smith's cell phone number from jail, if he's talking to his friends in jail, you could you can uncover a lot of stuff just because they're most likely talking about crime if they're talking from criminals to criminals. And a lot of it, like, it really helps provide more color to it. And not, like, you could say he's the number one guy, but then you could say, like, look at this. He's calling about delivering these here or going and beating up this person. It sounds more like a boss. And it really does sort of provide more detail. There's our jail here is the largest jail in the state of Texas, and it's bigger than Rikers Island. There's around almost 10,000 inmates from time to time. There's around 9,000 now, but all of those inmates making calls, and all of the calls, there's at one point in time I looked, there was about 1.5 million a year. And oof. Yeah, there's just a lot of data stored in there. And
I'm just thinking of the server space. Wow. All right. So I guess with that, though, you obviously work for the sheriff's office. And so maybe to get access wasn't that big a deal. But maybe is there any tips or tricks in terms of just access, going through the process, maybe for the first time accessing jail calls?
I'd say probably the tips and tricks would be just to message the people at like your sheriff's office. So the way it's kind of laid out here, there could be like Deer Park PD that's within the Harris County bubble, but it's a local PD, like a small city within the whole umbrella. And like you're an analyst there and you want access, would probably be to reach out to the sheriff's office if you have like a regional analyst group and ask them, because a lot of times there's third party systems that like overlay on top of jail calls that you can use to look at metrics or analyze the data. And a lot of those third party people, they want people to use this information because it's marketing for them pretty much. Like, I used your software to bust open the Sinaloa cartel or something. And so more often than not, they tend to throw out access, but you have to have CJIS certified and everything like that when they check your IP address. But it'd be just reach out to the sheriff's office and you'll be surprised, I guess, with if you just come up with okay enough reason, they'll give you access.
You just talked about listening to the audio call. Are they transcribed already to the point where if you were looking for a keyword, you could search the text?
A little bit, yes. It depends. There's been some news stories about software and mentions of it. But yeah, it's not the best, though. But you can.
I mean, yeah. I mean, and you could do that even if you would get the audio just for analysts listening here. If you have an audio conversation, there is software out there that you can add to this to get the transcript. That's how I actually get the transcript for the show. For those that ever want to, we've been publishing the transcript for shows for over a year now. But that's basically what I do is the software that I use to help edit this podcast also will give me a transcript. And I think even Microsoft actually has a free program that will put transcripts onto audio. I think it's limited to the amount that you can do in a given month, but at the same time, there's definitely software out there that'll help you that if you're looking to do that.
Mm-hmm. I attended a class at a Texas A&M for a little bit. It was just a one class session, and it was actually for marketing purposes to kind of give you like the breadth of the technology of like analyzing jail calls that's out there in the world. Is they took consumer based, like you're trying to call me about my car warranty, and they can actually take that call and break it down. He had 42 different data points based upon voice inflections of if the call was positive, if the call was negative, and then it would transcribe the call as well, of course. And then for like the call would be for that call would be like keyword searchable. So if you're looking for something in particular, you could. And I was just amazed, like, wow, you could just from someone's voice inflections detect if they were dishonest or stressful or anything. It was pretty wild. And that was about 2 years ago. And I was like, wow.
I mean, who's making warranty calls positive? I mean, they should be all negative at this point, right?
Right.
But it is funny. I was just talking to somebody about this. I don't know if they're getting better. I get very few robocalls, knock on wood, anymore. Right. I got them a lot there for a couple years, but now they've done a really good job. I've not had too many of these robocalls recently. So I think they're doing a lot better job of cracking down on that.
I agree. I think so. I think they passed some bill, hopefully.
Yeah. So I don't know. AI will get past it eventually, but hey, we'll enjoy it while it lasts. So, all right. So then let's see here. So let's move on then. And I think it's an interesting scenario here that you have, because it was around our time last year when we met at the conference. You were talking about that you were in the process of switching jobs to Houston PD.
Correct.
So one of the things when I contacted this time, I was like, hey, let's talk about your transition. And you said, oh, well, I got a story about that. So I do want to take a moment there and talk about your transition to Houston PD last year.
Yeah, most definitely. So once you make a LinkedIn account, people post jobs on LinkedIn all the time, and I can't even disable it. I don't know how to do it. I always get job postings like sent directly to my email, and a job posting popped up for HPD, and the salary was there, and they displayed the salary in full, and it was nicer. It was about a 25% pay bump. Yes.
Nicer is a good way to put it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's true. It's true. It's like, so I applied, I took the tests, I passed, and so I started there. There was a bit of a delay, and just sort of talking to my supervision and law enforcement, a lot of deputies and officers, they shift agencies. And sort of one of the unspoken rules was like, I'll give you like a week if you don't pan out, if it doesn't pan out well, before we like shred everything of yours. And so I was there, and being there for a week, I want to say, it is getting better. But at the time, the sheriff's office themselves, we had a new major over us. We had a chief who was really behind us, and we're pushing a lot, and we're being sent to conferences and everything and giving autonomy to do what we wanted. It was just a lot more opportunities once I got to the sheriff's office. I really didn't realize what I had. Like, the pay itself wasn't as good, but just, I want to say, just sort of the environment and the more opportunities to blossom and become a butterfly were more at the sheriff's office. And so there's just more set tasks, I think, at HPD. And I just had more freedom at the sheriff's office. And that's I feel one of the reasons why is just how sheriff's offices operate, because they're lower staffed than maybe PDs. Like, it's more of a side story, but we talk about our deputies working scenes allegedly do like a really great job because they don't have as many support units. So our deputies, we do have a crime scene team and a traffic team, but a lot of times they have to do that stuff themselves just because they're so short staffed. And so a lot of the philosophy of the sheriff's office is like, here's a badge and a gun. Good luck being the master of everything, because there's no help coming. And so I think so that the philosophy was. So we talked a little bit about it before in the pre-interview, but like, the grass isn't always greener on the other side.
Yeah. So I was going to go with that, or don't know what you got until it's gone. I was really debating there, but you're right. So just, I guess, in terms of Houston, how many analysts were at the unit that you were working at?
So it's for HPD or for the sheriff's
office? Yeah, HPD.
So yeah. It's sort of tough, and like, I'm not 100% sure what the number is, but I've heard quoted over 100.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah, and a lot of it is like, people have their niche or their region and they do their thing there. And it's sort of just, it's like sort of like very compartmentalized, like, this is what you're doing and just try to stick to it, you know, as best you can. And I have like lots of little squirrel moments, and I jump around, and that's kind of one thing that I realized that I kind of didn't miss. That I missed.
Yeah. And I mean, it is interesting, because it almost sounds like you got more into the more structure, more military ways that you've been accustomed to. And it, as you're doing both, it's nice to have some structure from now and then, but it's also nice to have freedom to be able to bounce around and to be creative in a way. And it does sound like at the sheriff's office here, you had that freedom and you had that ability to be creative.
No, like, agreed. And yeah, just lots of training opportunities too. And yeah.
So was it weird going back? Because I gotta believe, like, didn't we just have your goodbye party? Like, what are you doing here?
Yeah, it was. They were sort of holding off on the goodbye party because they weren't 100% sure if I was going to come. But they bought the cans of soda, 12 packs of soda, and we have monthly birthday parties, you know, so like for everybody in July, you know, there's three people in July. So we have like their monthly birthday party on like the first Monday of the month. And I would hear them talking smack about, these are the sodas from your goodbye party that didn't happen. And we'd be drinking Cokes. And then they also got me, they weren't supposed to give it to me, but I'd say up almost maybe like 6 or 7 months later, like, oh yeah, so-and-so's leaving. They're the ones who facilitated this nice little tiny plaque getting made. And it just said, Anthony Bush, you started here on January 1st, and now you're leaving like November 11th. And it was up there. And then when my coworkers seen, they're like, oh, this is such a lie. And they took some paper and they taped over the end year and put to be determined. And
oh, man, that's great.
I know. I think that's, if I do leave, just keep the same plaque and just update the piece of tape over
it. Yeah. We talk a lot on this show about transitioning. Right. I like to hear what goes into a decision to leave an analyst position. And there's lots of different reasons. And people normally talk about how they worked out. And this is what I accomplished here. And then I needed to move on, spread my wings and go over here and accomplish this. And but, you know, sometimes it's, as you mentioned, it's not always better. And you don't really have that ability to really make sure whether this is right or not, right? Like, as you mentioned, you had like a week or two. Okay. So it's like, okay, I got this, what's the saying? I got this landing pad that I can land on. And so, but it's only going to be there for a couple of weeks. So you had to make your decision pretty quickly and not really know. You just had to go with your gut at that point in time, I'm imagining.
Yeah. And then that's what I was pretty much a gut feeling, was like the window of opportunity is closing incredibly fast. So I was like, I just got to make that jump now. But I was lucky to have a really good command behind me. And then also, like, I know for some managers, I don't have that opportunity. You know, they just have to jump right into it and have to cut everything off. And now the privilege is definitely there, and I can recognize it.
Very good then. All right. Well, let's move on then. And let's talk about, I guess we talked a little bit already about jail calls. And I don't know if we missed. Did we get everything with the jail calls?
We did. For the most part, we got everything with the jail calls. One other interesting aspect of the jail calls I think most people might not know is a lot of departments really want to try to tackle family violence, and they don't necessarily know how to tackle it because it's in people's houses. How are you going to do anything with it? And so I was a part of a unit that focused on domestic violence and stalking. And my supervisor, his name's Brad Rudolph, he would say, and I believe him, he's like, 4 out of 5 murders are intimate partner murders. And a lot of them are men killing their wives or girlfriends or what have you. And sort of a strategy in order to sort of help mitigate that risk, the sort of the threat management aspect of it, was I figured out using SQL, I could export the phone numbers of domestic violence victims and then search them in bulk with the comma and the Securus app to sort of search for if somebody's in jail, are they calling that phone number? And if they are calling that phone number, were they the offender in the violent incident? In the state of Texas, there's no contact order that gets placed. So if you're detained for hitting, like, let's say, like your wife, you're not supposed to talk to them for, let's say, 45 days. And if they contact them from jail, the judge tells them right when they're arrested or right when they go see in front of a judge, hey, no contact. And that includes calling them on the phone. And using jail calls, you can just show them the call log to be like, look, John Smith called his wife after the assault. He wasn't supposed to. And that's felony charges. And it's not like a slam dunk one. It really depends on the district attorney, what they decide to do. But if it's a very much egregious case and you could see it escalating, like, they could use that to charge them with a felony and be like, you need to kind of stay in jail because this lady's life is at risk. And so that's one thing not a lot of people know about, I think, is trying to just search in bulk these domestic violence victims' phone numbers through the jail things to try to help mitigate the situation.
Yeah, interesting. And back to also to the social networking analysis, you mentioned not having fancy software, and you did it, you certainly your way in terms of Excel. Have you been able to use the fancy software, or at least demo the fancy software to get a taste of what you're missing type of thing?
I have. I've used, so Sam Houston State University, they're really pushing SNA, and I attended a class there and learned how to use Gephi. I played around with ArcPro. ArcPro has a social network analysis software that is the one I mainly use. And then our agency also sprung for the i2 notebook. That's pretty pricey. And so i2 notebook is simpler to use, but like, I guess I'm just a creature of habit, because before we had that, I just used the ArcPro just to develop the charts and lines. What I would do was I'd map the phone numbers and then I would connect them based upon the inmate. And then that's how you get a nice little chart. And then all the software, all the fancy software has link analysis features. So you can say what number has the highest eigenvector value or what number has the most betweenness. And for translations, the eigenvector value is sort of like the general of an army or like a police chief or a sheriff. They're connected to the people who are connected to a lot of people. So they're sort of like issue the orders in a network. And then for betweenness score, that's just the person who's connected to the most amount of people based upon like the shortest path. They have the shortest path to the most amount of people. And but it's ironic. I was talking to, I forget who exactly the doctor's name is. It's not Dr. Wells, but over at Sam Houston, he had one of the students get a job at the district attorney's. And they're telling the story. And I've had the same experience of with social network analysis. You can just tell them your insights you've made and then just give them the chart. And people really don't care about the scores or anything like that. They're just like, I'll take your word on it that this guy's important or this is important. And just give me the picture.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's probably we had this conversation a little bit in the prep call. Is like, I am really surprised that social network analysis isn't more mainstream in terms of police departments. And I think maybe it is because of the nerdiness, the math that's behind it. I'm not exactly sure, but I attended a class at the University of Kentucky. I think it was about 2010, and I would have guess that by this time now that social networking analysis would be bread and butter at police departments. And I don't think it really has taken off as much as I thought it would. There's a lot that can go into it. And I think there's a lot of science that can go into it, which is the fascinating thing, that why aren't more people picking this up? Is it kind of surprising me, given that there's actual science behind how the calculations are made.
That's definitely agreed. I've read some academic papers just because we're very close to Sam Houston. We even have like an MOU with them, and we have interns from Sam Houston State University working with us. And just sort of seeing a lot of the academic papers, I think part of it is just access to data and then access to the results of said data, like a lack of feedback. I attended a social network analysis conference, and it was on human trafficking. Well, not a conference, but a class, and it was on human trafficking. And at the end of the presentation, I asked the presenter, I was like, what was kind of like the end goal of it? And it was, they like, to be honest, I'm not entirely sure. We sent all of our findings and our results to the investigators, but we didn't hear anything back. And so that, I think that aspect of it, that is just sort of like just the data silos. Talking with another analyst, like the big problem is like, you only really get your good insights when you fuse two different like data sets together, when you can like fuse jail calls with gang members or crime incidents or visitations or bank transactions. And so, but to get access to all that sort of data, that's like a tall order. Like, you have to get the permission from a lot of people. And then you need to really know how to use Excel to link it all together. But to sort of like to add a little bit more onto like being the next best thing since sliced bread is, like I mentioned with like our jail calls, like 1 year is 1.5 million. And if you add it all up, you get to a couple millions. And how do you know what to listen to? And it really helps filter down everything to just, it really helps distill things to like just listen to these calls. It really helps saves time.
Yeah. Well, back to your military example, when you're doing the geospatial and you're looking for targets, and how are you going to disable this network? And that's one of the key concepts in social network analysis. It's like, okay, what do we need to do to disrupt this network? And sometimes you can just look at the data and know the situation and understand who the major players are. But every once in a while, data will show you something that will surprise you.
100%. Like, for example, for like it was a pretty big analysis of a gang with over 1,700 members. The number one highlighted person, he was under federal investigation. And then the number fourth one was also under federal investigation. And so I talked with some of the people there who were investigating, because I just figured out the like deconfliction aspect of it. And I think one of the highlights is that these other agencies, like, they don't know that these people were investigating them. So like the people investigating the number four guy, I introduced them to the lady who was investigating the number one guy, and they really, eventually they would have collided together, I think, with their investigations, but it sort of helped out. And then second of all, like, they don't know maybe who the number three guy is, or the number two guy is, or the number five. And it's sort of, it helps, I guess, lead credence to the cause of like, hey, we should continue this investigation despite like the difficulties, because this person is so important, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's, there's a lot to it. And there is, and I recommend to all analysts to take some kind of social network analysis course. I really do think that it's worthwhile, and I think there's a lot to learn, especially if you are doing case support. It's really should be a requirement.
Agreed. It helps even link cases together and to show or just structures. Even if with I2, there's a fellow analyst named Erin Havelka. She does a great job with I2, and she just takes all these different investigator reports with all these different insights and helps link it together. Like, this criminal syndicate here owns this auto body shop, and then they own this other auto body shop. And it helps like investigators and even attorneys, the prosecutors, of, you know, heads or tails of things, rather than just a stack of 100 documents. It's all visualized nicely on a big printout.
Yeah. All right, let's get into some more advice then. And so for our listeners, you've gotten into presenting recently.
Yes.
So what are your go-to tips for presenting?
It's very nerve-wracking, I want to say, in the very beginning. But after the first 5 minutes or so, then your nerves start to loosen up. And I want to say, present on something you like. And mm-hmm. So like, I present on social network analysis, and I show a breakdown of like human trafficking, linking adult ads online with like outbound jail calls to kind of show like these human trafficking networks, and then showing like defining what it is and how to do it, step-by-step process, and where to get the data and how to sell it. And there's so many other aspects of private analysis that you can really break that down and do. So I guess my recommendation presenting is, I'd say look at like the IECA presentations over the years that they put out, and look at the ILEA presentations, and even your like your regional, like here in Texas, we have TexLane, and they're putting on their own conference and looking at those and sort of seeing like what's lacking there, and then and then just pick something you enjoy and then present it. And you can start small. You can do a half hour and then maybe do an hour. And then if you're kind of real nervous, just pick a buddy, like one of your coworkers that you like, and they can present with them too, so you can bounce it off each other. But I think more people need to get out there and to help really spread the good word of
Yeah, there's definitely some do's and don'ts. And even I got into some don'ts. I've presented plenty over my career, and it is a struggle at times. Like, I think when you're first starting out and you're nervous, you want as much focus off of you as possible. So you have the PowerPoint slide, or you have all the something for them to look at, so it doesn't feel like they're just looking at you as you're talking. So I think there's something to be said about what story are you telling? What are the key points and what they want to walk away with? And I think that helps you stay focused. It's like, what do you want them to get out of this? Sometimes it can be really hard. Right. It doesn't, that might sound simple. It's like, oh, I want them, like, if I'm teaching Excel and I'm teaching a bunch of tips and tricks, it's pretty easy. Like, okay, I'm hoping that one of these you didn't know already and that you're taking this home and using it. But when you're doing other presentations, it might not be so straightforward of like, what are the three or four things that you want your audience to get out of this presentation?
I took a T. Cole instructor class, and that was one of the things that they really brought up, was learning objectives. As far as like, before you really start building your presentation, you need to figure out what the learning objectives are, and they should be concrete enough you could sort of put them in a test, like what is a node or a tie, or what is an RMS system. And so far, like, I think that has helped shape some of my presentations.
I would say so too. And there's so much to learn in terms of presenting. I mean, I presented once just on graphic design, like better by design, and talked about colors and spacing, and we talked about font before, and there's a science to all that. There's a whole degree on graphic design that you can learn, and marketing, and what's the best way to present one page of data. And so there's so much out there, I think, to learn. And I think a lot of that will go a long way for analysts as they're trying to get their stuff read and make sure that their stuff is consumed.
I mentioned it a little bit before we were talking, like the pre-interview was like, I did not know before I got into like Intel how important it was of the visual appearance and communication. I've seen, you can see just like a wall of text on a piece of paper. And I don't know if it's because of TikTok or everyone's attention spans, but it is tough to get through that single sheet of paper, as opposed to like, here's a paragraph with a map of where this incident took place. Like, here's a picture of a suspect on it too. And then here's like a little data table of all the different incidents compared to, it could be more detailed, the wall of text, but just with images. And even like we're talking about with presenting and some of the struggles there and what not to do is, I compared my presentations I gave at the start compared to the presentations that I give now. And the slideshow size has increased, but that's just because there's more visuals to talk about. And the more visuals you have, it prevents you from reading from the slide but you're just explaining the visual. For example, like you'd have a map up and you'd just be talking about the map.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's finish up with personal interest then. And you are currently watching True Detective.
Yes, I watched. Have you watched the most recent season at all?
I have not now. So have you seen all the seasons?
I skipped season 2 with Vince Vaughn in it. I watched a little bit of it. It just didn't hook me, but I watched the rest of them.
That's funny. Yeah, because 1 was so fantastic.
Yeah.
Like 1 was like, I recommend that to anybody. Like, stop what you're doing. Go watch season 1 of True Detective. It's just... And when I say season, for those that might not know, there's a whole story there in itself. It's not cumulative to season 2. Each season's a different story. And so I did watch season 2 because I loved season 1 so much. And I just I had a hard time getting through it. And like, I think if I watched it again, maybe I would like it better. But I had trouble. Trouble keeping my attention. I didn't even watch season 3, and I haven't even started watching season 4.
Season 4 is a lot like season 1 in the aspect it sort of brings back the supernatural elements of it, and then it works its way back. I definitely feel like for season 2, it was a tough act to follow, I want to say. So you watch and you're like, oh, first, the art style's not there, the writing's not there, or what it once was. But definitely a lot of the reviews are for season 4. It's fully out now. I haven't watched all of it, but pretty much it follows investigator in Alaska and some sketchy business happening up there in the Arctic Circle entirely at night. And yeah. I really don't know how they're going to wrap it up, to be honest, because so much of the supernatural aspect of it to ground it back in reality. But it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, so it's starring Jodie Foster. So I just imagine Clarice from Silence of the Lambs, but I'm sure that's not the same character.
No. She's a bittered police chief now of having to deal with it and deal with, ironically enough, the state of Anchorage, or like the Anchorage state troopers try to come and try to take her case of these mysterious dead people. And she's trying to solve the case before they take it over.
All right. Well, hey, if you are a True Detective fan, leave us a comment down below on what you think and maybe what your favorite season was, other than season 1, if you like 2, 3, or 4. So, all right, Anthony, let's finish up with words to the world then. This is where I give the guest the last word. You can promote any idea that you wish. What are your words to the world?
I mean, I guess my words to the world here is sort of try your best to help other people. Like, if you see them struggling, and I don't mean do the work for them. I have that issue where I try to, like, somebody's doing something and I think they're taking too slow, so I try to take over. But just try to support somebody if you see them struggling, if they're working on something for 5 hours and you know it should only take an hour and you actually see them over there working on it, sweating up a storm, is to just go and help them, because you don't know, something could be happening going on in their personal life, or they just don't understand the software, but just to help them out.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Anthony. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
You too, sir. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for making it to the end of another episode of Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. You can show your support by sharing this and other episodes found on our website at www.leapodcasts.com. If you have a topic you would like us to cover or have a suggestion for our next guest, please send us an email at leapodcasts@gmail.com. Till next time, analysts, keep talking.